Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First person. The magic of these book-lined buildings. Palaces, really. Filled my childhood with delight. Parenthood helped me experience that bliss again. Here's Susan Orlean from her book, The Library Book, with The Library, A Love Story, in Reader's Digest. I grew up in libraries, or at least it feels that way. I was raised in the suburbs of Cleveland, just a few blocks from the brick-faced Bertram Woods branch of the Shaker Heights Public Library system. I went there several times a week with my mother. She and I would walk in together, but as soon as we passed through the door, we each headed to our favorite section. The library might have been the first place I was ever given autonomy. Even when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, I was allowed to head off on my own. Then, after a while, my mother and I would reunite at the checkout counter with our finds. Together, we'd wait as the librarian pulled out the date card and stamped it with the checkout machine. That giant fist thumping the card with a loud chunk chunk, printing a crooked due date underneath a score of previous crooked due dates that belonged to other people, other times. Those visits were dreamy, frictionless interludes that promised I would leave richer than I'd arrived. It wasn't like going to a store with my mom, which guaranteed a tug of war between what I wanted and what my mother was willing to buy me. In the library, I could have anything I wanted. After we checked out, I loved being in the car and having all the books we'd gotten stacked on my lap, pressing me under their solid, warm weight, their Mylar covers sticking a bit to my thighs. It was such a thrill leaving a place with things you hadn't paid for, such a thrill anticipating the new books we would read. On the ride home, my mom and I talked about the order in which we were going to read our books, a solemn conversation in which we planned how to pace ourselves through this charmed, evanescent period of grace until the books were due. When I was older, I usually walked to the library by myself, lugging back as many books as I could carry. Occasionally, I did go with my mother, and the trip would be as enchanted as it had been when I was small. Even when I was in my last year of high school and could drive myself to the library, my mother and I still went together now and then, and the trip unfolded exactly as it had when I was a child, with all the same beats and pauses and comments and reveries, the same perfect, pensive rhythm we'd followed so many times before. When I miss my mother these days, since she died 2 years ago, I like to picture us in the car together, going for one more magnificent trip to Bertram Woods. My parents valued books, but they grew up in the Depression, aware of the quicksilver nature of money, and they had learned the hard way that you shouldn't buy what you could borrow. Because of that frugality, or perhaps independent of it, they also believed that you read a book for the experience of reading it. You didn't read it in order to have an object that had to be housed and looked after forever, a memento of the purpose for which it was obtained. The reading of the book was a journey. There was no need for souvenirs. Our uncrowded bookshelves at home had several sets of encyclopedias, an example of something not convenient to borrow from the library, since you reached for it regularly and urgently, and an assortment of other books that, for one reason or another, my parents had ended up with. There were some travel guides, some coffee table books, a few of my father's law books, and a dozen or so novels that were either gifts or somehow managed to justify being owned outright. When I left for college, one of the many ways I differentiated myself from my parents was that I went wild for owning books. I think buying textbooks was what got me going. All I know is that I lost my appreciation for the slow pace of making your way through a library and for having books on borrowed time. As soon as I got my own apartment, I lined it with bookcases and loaded them with hardcovers. I turned into a ravenous buyer of books. I loved the alkaline tang of new ink and paper, a smell that never emanated from a broken-in library book. I loved the crack of a newly flexed spine and the way the brand new pages felt almost damp, as if they were wet with creation. Sometimes I fantasized about starting a bookstore. If my mother ever mentioned to me that she was on the waiting list for some book at the library, I got annoyed and asked why she didn't just go buy it. I might have spent the rest of my life thinking about libraries only wistfully, the way I thought about, say, the amusement park I went to as a kid. Libraries might have become just a bookmark of memory more than an actual place, a way to call up an emotion of a moment that occurred long ago, something that was fused with quote-unquote mother and quote-unquote the past in my mind. But in 2011, my husband accepted a job in Los Angeles, so we left New York and headed west. My son was in first grade when we moved. One of his first school assignments was to interview someone who worked for the city. I suggested talking to a garbage collector or a police officer, but he said he wanted to interview a librarian. We were so new to town that we had to look up the address of the closest library, which was the Los Angeles Public Library's Studio City branch. It was about a mile away from our house, about the same distance that the Bertram Woods branch had been from my childhood home. As my son and I drove to meet the librarian, I was flooded by a sense of absolute familiarity, a gut-level recollection of this journey of parent and child on their way to the library. I had taken this trip so many times before, but now it was turned on its head, and I was the parent bringing my child on that special trip. We parked, and my son and I walked toward the library, taking it in for the first time. The building was white and modish, with a mint-green mushroom cap of a roof. From the outside, it didn't look anything like the stout brick Bertram Woods branch, but when we stepped in, the thunderbolt of recognition struck me so hard that it made me gasp. Decades had passed, and I was 2,000 miles away, but I felt as if I had been whisked back to that precise time and place, walking into the library with my mother. Nothing had changed. There was the same soft tisk, tisk, tisk of pencil on paper and the muffled murmuring from patrons at the tables at the center of the room and the creak and groan of book carts and the occasional papery clunk of a book dropped on a desk. The scarred wooden checkout counters and the librarians' desks as big as boats and the bulletin board with its fluttering raggedy notices were all the same. The sense of gentle, steady busyness, like a pot of water on a rolling boil, was just the same. The books on the shelves, with some subtractions and additions, were certainly the same. It wasn't that time stopped in the library. It was as if it were captured here, collected here, and in all libraries, and not only my time, my life, but all human time as well. In the library, time is dammed up. Not just stopped, but saved. The library is a gathering pool of narratives and of the people who come to find them. It is where we can glimpse immortality. In the library, we can live forever. So the spell that libraries had once cast on me was renewed. Maybe it had never really been broken, although I had been away long enough that it was like visiting a country I'd loved but had forgotten as my life went galloping by. I knew that part of what hooked me had been the shock of familiarity I felt when I took my son to our local library, the way it telegraphed my childhood, my relationship to my parents, my love of books. It brought me close, in my musings, to my mother and to our sojourns to the library. It was wonderful and it was bittersweet because just as I was rediscovering those memories, my mother was losing all of hers. When I first told her that I was writing a book about libraries, she was delighted and said that she was proud that she'd had a part in making me find them wondrous. But soon the dark fingers of dementia got her in their grip, and they pried loose bits of her memory every day. The next time I reminded her about the project and told her how much I had been thinking about our trips to Bertram Woods, she smiled with encouragement but with no apparent recognition of what I meant. Each time I visited, she receded a little more. She became vague, absent, isolated in her thoughts, or maybe in some pillowy blankness that filled in where the memories had been chipped away, and I knew that I was both carrying the remembrance for both of us. The writer Amadou Hampate Ba once said that in Africa, when an old person dies, it is like a library has burned. When I first heard the phrase, I didn't understand it, but over time I came to realize it was perfect. Our minds and souls contain volumes inscribed by our experiences and emotions. Each individual's consciousness is a collection of memories we've cataloged and stored inside us, a private library of a life lived. It is something that no one else can entirely share. It burns down and disappears when we die. But if you can take something from your internal collection and share it with one person or with a larger world, on the page or in a story told, it takes on a life of its own. Next, from Reader's Digest, Only in America. Hopeful hunters are scouring the Rockies for a chest full of gold, jewels, and artifacts reportedly worth millions. Where exactly is it? The clues lie in A Mysterious Poem. Here's The Man Who Buried a Treasure by Eric Spitznagel from The National in Reader's Digest. Please don't say I buried it, says the email from Forrest Fenn, the 88-year-old retired antiques dealer from New Mexico who engineered one of the biggest treasure hunts of the 21st century. Just say I hid it. I read this line over and over, wondering what Fenn meant, and looking for a clue. He didn't write, I never buried the treasure. He just doesn't want me to tell anybody else he did, which means... ... What exactly? My mind races, and I briefly consider giving up on journalism to become a full-time treasure hunter. That is the power of Forrest Fenn's treasure, a prize that in the past 8 years has lured a surprisingly large and enthusiastic group of treasure hunters. Fenn and his wife ran a high-end gallery in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and that amassed a personal collection that included Sitting Bull's original peace pipe and a mummified falcon from King Tut's tomb. In 1988, Fenn was diagnosed with kidney cancer. Faced with his own mortality, he came up with a crazy scheme. He would bury some of his favorite artifacts somewhere in the Rocky Mountains and then die next to them. My desire was to hide the treasure and let my body stay there and go back to the soil, he explains. He beat the cancer and put the treasure idea on hold for 2 decades, until his 80th birthday, when he decided to finally go through with it, minus the dying in the wilderness part. Fenn filled an antique bronze lockbox measuring 10 inches by 10 inches with hundreds of treasures, gold coins and nuggets, rubies, diamonds, emeralds, Chinese jade carvings, and pre-Columbian gold bracelets. The contents are worth somewhere between $1 million and $5 million, based on estimates Fenn has given over the years. Then he took his treasure chest out into the Rockies and hid it. He wanted it to be found. That was the whole point. But he wasn't going to just give it away. This country was going into a recession, he writes to me. People were losing their jobs, and despair was the headline in every paper. I wanted to give some hope to those who were willing to go into the mountains looking for a treasure. In the year 2010, Fenn self-published his memoir, The Thrill of the Chase. In addition to stories about his adventures as an Air Force pilot and selling moccasins to the Rockefellers, it includes a 24-line poem that Fenn claims contains 9 clues that, quote, will lead to the end of my rainbow and the treasure, unquote. and I'll be reading that poem at the conclusion of this article. At first, nobody really noticed. The thrill of the chase was sold only in a local New Mexico bookstore, but word spread, and by the year 2011, there was a small community of determined hunters. Once the media told Fenn's story, the chase was on. The book is now out of print, and copies show up on Amazon for as much as $3,200. Fenn estimates that 350,000 people from across the globe have searched or are currently searching for his treasure, yet nobody has found it. How, one might reasonably wonder, could that be? The problem with Fenn's poem, or perhaps the reason it has become such an obsession, is that the quote-unquote clues can be interpreted a million different ways. The quote-unquote home of Brown, for instance, could be Brown's Canyon National Monument in Colorado, or Brown Cemetery in Montana, or Brown Hill in New Mexico, or a cabin, or a bear. Maybe it's the color brown, or maybe the treasure is hidden under some porta-potties. Don't laugh. Several people have already looked. The treasure has attracted an eclectic bunch of hunters, including Tim Nobody, who collects pinball machines, a one-legged motorcycle rider named Michael Hendrickson, and a Connecticut woman everybody calls Grandma. Dal Neitzel, 72 years old, manages a community cable TV station in Bellingham, Washington, and has taken about 70 road trips in search of the treasure. He runs a blog named The Thrill of the Chase that has become an online hub for hunters to post theories about where Fenn might have stashed all that gold. He gets thousands of visitors a day. Marty Kreis from Blue Ridge, Georgia, better known by her handle, Diggin' Gypsy, searches an average of 7 times a year, 4 weeks at a time. The 49-year-old grandmother is usually joined by her extended family and, room permitting, a pet rooster named John Wayne. She searches only in West Yellowstone, Montana, no longer bothering with Wyoming, Colorado, or New Mexico, the other 3 mountain states where the treasure might be hidden. She says it's because Fenn once blogged about her, claiming, "If I were a betting man, I'd bet on this woman." That was enough for Christ to think she was on the right track. She's hardly the only optimist. The truly devoted meet in June for an annual gathering in New Mexico called Fennbury. Since the year 2014, when only 10 people attended, it has grown to become a hot ticket, with hundreds mingling around campfires and sharing stories. With so much at stake, there are also rivalries and infighting. Some people claim that the treasure never existed. Fenn should be arrested for scamming, a local once grumbled to the Santa Fe New Mexican, or that it was discovered long ago and never reported. Some frightening people have come out of the woodwork in search of the valuable cash. A Nevada man pleaded guilty to stalking after he became convinced that the treasure was actually Fenn's granddaughter. Another searcher, a Pennsylvania man who was certain that it was hidden in Fenn's home, was arrested after he used an axe to break in. And Fenn wrote to one overeager sleuth, quote, "Please don't dig up my parents' graves," unquote. Then there are the fatalities. 4 people have died while searching, 3 of them in the summer of 2017. Jeff Murphy, who fell 500 feet while hiking in Yellowstone National Park, Eric Ashby, who drowned while rafting the Arkansas River in Colorado, and Paris Wallace, whose body was discovered 7 miles from his car in the New Mexico mountains. It's a peculiar plot twist, given that thousands have been searching for Fenn's treasure since the year 2011. Has the terrain gotten inexplicably more treacherous, or have the searchers started taking bigger risks? Fenn, who has been loath to give away additional clues, "It's all in the poem," he would tell inquisitive hunters, has recently started sharing more details. After Ashby's drowning, he wrote in a blog post, "Please remember that I was about 80 when I made 2 trips from my vehicle to where I hid the treasure. Please be cautious and don't take risks." More clues he has revealed. The treasure isn't in a mine. I mean, they have snakes in them, he has said. Or a tunnel. It's between 5,000 feet and 10,200 feet above sea level. It's not in Canada or Idaho or Utah or a graveyard. Where warm waters halt is not a dam, and it's not, quote, on top of any mountain, though it may be close to the top, unquote. When I asked why the searchers didn't seem to be getting any closer, Fenn told me that, quote, they don't seem to be focusing on the first clue, unquote. He, of course, did not reveal what that first clue was. Why are Fenn's treasure hunters so into what seems like a ridiculous thing to do with their time? Many are quick to say that their lives have been enriched by their experiences. Neitzel says that prior to learning of Fenn's treasure, he never took a walk that wasn't necessary, but in the past decade he has climbed mountains. Christ will tell you how she used to cower in her tent, terrified of grizzlies or other wild beasts, but now feels fearless. It's changed us, she says. My sisters and daughters, we're brave Viking women. Nothing scares us anymore. For some, such as Bill Sullivan of Seattle, the mystery of Fenn's treasure chest is literally all they have. Sullivan, 60 years old, is homeless and lives mostly out of his car. He'd like to have a roof over his head and dependable meals. But that's not why he's focused on Fenn's elusive jackpot. For him, it's about following in the footsteps of his ancestors. My grandfather prospected gold in Alaska 100 years ago, Sullivan says. He had a sled dog team and trapped beaver, so that's in my blood. The big question, will Fenn's treasure, assuming it really exists, ever be found? Neitzel says he has no intention of stopping until he or somebody else finds it. I know I'm kidding myself, he says, laughing. But he took 4 trips last summer and fall. What people get wrong is, it's not all just about finding the treasure. It's about finding treasures, plural. It's about getting outside and exploring. That's why Forrest called his book The Thrill of the Chase. It's not the thrill of the find. Many claim that even if they found Fenn's chest, they wouldn't necessarily spend the money and might even rehide the chest. Sullivan says he'd like to keep the chase going for a new generation. Wouldn't it be a hoot to be the wise guy writing the new poem, he says. As for Fenn, he hopes someone finds the treasure while he's still alive. Several people have been within a few hundred feet, he says. He knows because they've emailed him and asked whether they were close. Fenn, who's not about to give anyone a free pass, said nothing. But he reads every email, many of which can be surprisingly revealing about the type of people who would drop everything to go hunting for gold. They confess their fears. They thank him for saving their marriages, for giving them a reason to take a risk, for giving their lives meaning. Fenn received one email from a law student thanking him, quote, for reminding me of a part of who I am that has waned greatly during the last years of my legal studies, unquote. Responding with an impassioned plea that offered more clues to his real intentions than any of the secrets hidden in his poem, Fenn told the man, "Don't you dare work as a lawyer. If you do, you will wear a coat and tie, sit at a desk all day. You will not have time to smell the sky or experience the soft breeze ripe with sun. Go looking for my chest full of gold and all the other treasures that lurk once you leave the fluorescent lights behind." Another hunter had this tantalizing insight. Somewhere deep inside, I hope that I never find your treasure. The journey will be treasure enough. And so the hunt continues. And now for Forrest Fenn's $1 million riddle. Listen carefully now. As I have gone alone in there and with my treasures bold, I can keep my secret where and hint of riches new and old. Begin it where warm waters halt and take it in the canyon down. Not far, but too far to walk, put in below the home of brown. From there, it's no place for the meek, the end is ever drawing nigh. There'll be no paddle up your creek, just heavy loads and water high. If you've been wise and found the blaze, look quickly down, your quest to cease. But tarry scant with marvel gaze, just take the chest and go in peace. So why is it I must go and leave my trove for all to seek? The answers I already know. I've done it tired, and now I'm weak. So hear me all, and listen good. Your effort will be worth the cold. If you are brave and in the wood, I give you title to the gold. Let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with some news from the world of medicine. Sunlight kills germs even indoors. Researchers from the University of Oregon and Harvard University collected dust from homes in the Eugene, Oregon area and placed it in rooms exposed to the sun's visible rays. It's ultraviolet light or no light at all. 90 days later, the dark rooms had twice as many living bacteria as the sunlit rooms, including bacteria related to respiratory pathogens, while the UV rooms had slightly fewer bacteria than the visible light ones did. So remember, going outside can improve health in many ways. But even at home, you should let the sun shine in. Psoriasis treatment may prevent heart attacks. In a recent study of 84 patients with psoriasis, a chronic inflammatory skin disease, those who received treatment with biologic drugs, that is, drugs produced from or containing elements of living organisms, they had fewer coronary plaques than those who did not. Coronary plaques, made up of fat, cholesterol, and other substances, can block arteries and cause a heart attack. The biologic treatments not only reduced the volume of plaque by 40% over 1 year, but it also caused it to become less inflammatory, further reducing heart attack risk. Since biologics are not FDA approved to treat coronary artery disease, they are not likely to be covered by insurance. Ask your doctor about using them off-label. A herpes link to Alzheimer's. Could that pesky cold sore be responsible for your unreliable memory? Multiple studies suggest that there's a link between several common herpes viruses and the onset of Alzheimer's disease. In one study, at least 70% of elderly people, including those with Alzheimer's, had HSV-1, the herpes simplex virus that causes cold sores, in their brains. Moreover, those who had both HSV-1 and the APOE4 gene, which has already been linked to Alzheimer's, were much more likely to develop the brain disease than those without either. Meanwhile, a 2018 analysis of nearly 1,000 brains from brain banks showed a strong connection between Alzheimer's and the human herpes viruses HHV-6A and HHV-7, which lead to the childhood rash roseola. Whether neither of these studies proves that herpes viruses cause Alzheimer's, a third study found that patients infected with herpes who had sought antiviral treatment, that is, using drugs such as acyclovir, cut their risk of developing dementia later in life by a factor of 10. And finally, celiac and hidden gluten. Managing celiac disease usually requires ingesting 10 milligrams or less of gluten per day, but this is easier said than done, according to a recent study. The stool and urine of people trying to follow a gluten-free diet revealed that they were being exposed to an estimated average of 150 to 400 milligrams per day. Lesser-known sources include certain medications, sauces, lipsticks, condiments, and vitamins. Read ingredient lists carefully for words that may signal gluten, including triticale, hydrolyzed wheat protein, malt, and seitan. Thank you for listening to today's Reader's Digest. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.